Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the testimony today before the House Intelligence Committee by FBI Director James Comey and the head of the NSA, Admiral Rogers, into ongoing investigations into possible collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians. James Henry, the author of Blood Bankers, who is an expert on offshore and pirate banking and kleptocracy, joins us to examine questions that focused on the money trail between the Trump campaign and the Trump Organization and Russian oligarchs that seem to indicate that is where the investigation is perhaps heading, as well as the definitive rejection by both Rogers and Comey of the explosive charge Trump made that Obama had wiretapped him, which he has yet to retract or apologize for, given Trump's accompanying smear of Obama, who he called a bad or sick guy. Then we'll look into the apparent death of the long-held notion that partisanship ends at America's shores, which was on display today as members of the House Intelligence Committee appeared to be operating in two different universes, with Democrats probing reports of possible collusion between Trump and the Russians, while Republican congressmen went to extraordinary lengths to shift the focus onto leakers and press reports. Locke Johnson, Regents Professor of Political Science at the University of Georgia, who served on the staffs of both House and Senate Oversight Committees, joins us to discuss the raw partisan nature of the probe, which nevertheless established that there is an ongoing investigation into collusion between Trump and the Russians, and that there was no factual basis to Trump's claim that Obama wiretapped him. Then finally, we'll discuss the other major hearing today before the Senate Judiciary Committee into the confirmation of Donald Trump's nominee to the Supreme Court, Judge Neil Gorsuch. Garrett Epps, a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law and author of American Justice 2014, Nine Clashing Visions on the Supreme Court, joins us to discuss his article at The Atlantic, Gorsuch's Selective View of Religion. And joining us now is James Henry, an investigative economist and lawyer who has written widely about offshore and onshore tax havens, kleptocracy, and pirate banking. The author of Blood Bankers, he's a senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable Investment, a Global Justice Fellow at Yale, a senior advisor to the Tax Justice Network, and co-founder with David K. Johnston of DCReports.org, where he has an article, Wilbur Ross Comes to DC with an Unexamined History of Russian Connections. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Good to be with you.
And Jim, what's your sense of the hearings today? I mean, they're clearly hopelessly partisan. But, you know, obviously the Democrats were trying to find out where this probe is heading and what is the extent to which there are ties or collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians. And the Republicans were trying to blame it all on leaks and press reports that they didn't agree with. But my sense of it was that the questioning from the Democrats indicate that maybe what they're onto is the money trail.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, it sounds like certainly, I mean, Comey couldn't answer any of those questions. It was a kind of kabuki theater. You know, not only did he tell us that there's no evidence that Trump was wiretapped, which I guess everybody else agrees with as well, you know, that there is an ongoing investigation. The scope of that, however, may just be limited to, you know, this question of whether there was collusion between the Putin team and the Trump team in terms of during the campaign. And I think that's far too narrow. I mean, what we've learned in the last few months since, you know, I wrote a piece about this in the American Interest back in December, is that there's an extraordinary number of deals that Trump did, not in Russia, but with Russia and former Soviet Union capital involved and partners involved, many of whom are, you know, oligarchs, kind of people with dodgy backgrounds, people who are convicted felons. And there's not just one project here. I mean, we have the Trump Soho, we have the Trump Tower in Toronto, we have the Ocean Club, Panama, $400 million project there. All of these projects, Azerbaijan, the New Yorker has written extensively about the Baku project. In all these cases, you have the same kind of patterns. And I'd like the Democrats to expand the scope of their activities, include the possibility that, you know, the reason Trump is was able to survive after 2000 when he had had six bankruptcies under his belt and no bank would lend to him, was because of flight capital streaming out of the former Soviet Union and getting involved in lots of dirty money flushing into the projects like the Trump Soho, where it looks like many of the same business practices were going on. This is what I think which should really be added to the list of questions that they're asking about.
But if they're narrowly focusing on whether there was collusion, whether they can prove collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians, what happened to the original finding of all the intelligence agencies, the consensus of all 17 intelligence agencies, that said that the Russians interfered in our elections? This was directed by Putin himself, and it was designed at helping elect Trump. And I, through today's hearings, both Admiral Rogers and the FBI director reinforced those findings.
Well, that's right. Those findings hold up. I think what they're trying, the Democrats have been trying to go beyond that to implicate members of the Trump team and all that. I mean, there's nothing necessarily about, if Putin decides to deploy hackers to help Trump on his own, that's different from if he's working on a, kind of closely coordinated basis with the Trump team. I mean, one of the last articles I wrote was about this fellow, Ribolovlev, who had an Airbus 319 that was basically bird dogging Donald Trump's jets during the campaign season all over the United States, Los Angeles and Las Vegas and North Carolina. He's, his Airbus turns up. Hey, what was that about? This is the same guy that was investing alongside Wilbur Ross in the Bank of Cyprus. He was the guy that bought Donald Trump's house in 2008. Is this just a random set of connections? I mean, we need to get to the bottom of who some of these private connections are that were involved with the Trump, sort of preserving the Trump dynasty.
So, James Henry, my understanding is that Ribolovlev, is the oligarch, is the same character that bought a property from Donald Trump down in Florida that Trump bought for $40 million and then sold it to this guy a few years later for close to $100 million. And then the guy, and it was apparently a wreck, and the guy tore it down. And a lot of people think that that was actually a payoff. I mean, who makes deals like that?
Well, I mean, I would put it this way. This is what we know about that. The transaction came at a very convenient time for Donald Trump because he was in the middle of the 2008 recession. And his property values were, like most commercial real estate developers, their properties were in trouble. He was about to default on a $40 million personal loan on a Chicago project that he had from Deutsche Bank, the only big bank that would lend to him in the 2000s after he had six bankruptcies prior to 2000. As of September 2008, he's actually suing Deutsche Bank to get out of his loan, claiming force majeure because he claimed the big banks had created this recession. But Ribolovlev comes along in June and pays him about $95 million net of the commission for a property that Trump had bought in 2004 for $41 million. Conveniently, another a $50 million gain just at that point. So no question that Ribolovlev was buying into a market that was already sinking in terms of housing value, and in fact, he has lost money on the property. He subdivided it and sold off a third of it 2016 for much less than he had paid for it per acre. So, this was a peculiar transaction for a guy who prided himself on being a successful Russian business guy. And he also turns up as Wilbur Ross's partner in the Bank of Cyprus. He turns up, this airplane following Trump all around the planet on during the election campaign. So, this is not something we can say is more than circumstantial at this point, but we'd certainly like to know about all these various connections. For me, today's hearing underlined a couple things. One is Republicans are actually woefully ignorant about all of this stuff. I mean, the chairman, Nunes, of his committee, didn't even know, you know, who some of the key players, and it's like Carter Page, are, and, you know, the dirty trickster from Republican years, who was implicated.
Roger Stone.
Yeah. So, you know, the fact he'd never heard those names and couldn't understand who, what the Democrats were asking about, you know, is an indication that this fellow is, you know, not very well informed to begin with. Secondly, they're much more obsessed with the leakers of the information about Flynn than about the substance of the leaks and, you know, these very curious connections. So I am come away from this first day of the hearings to say, well, we really do need to take this out of, you know, this kind of partisan Congress, you know, and have some kind of independent investigation that's staffed. We go back to the Watergate days. Journalists could do so much, you know, but by 1974, you got into a situation, if it hadn't been for Sam Ervin and basically a bipartisan Watergate committee, you would have never had people like John Dean testifying under oath, the guy who ran the Watergate bugging system, you know, that it was so crucial to the tapes that Nixon had to essentially resign. Alexander Butterworth.
But no, Alexander Butterfield. He's an old friend of mine.
Alexander Butterfield. Yes,
right.
You got the names right. So this is the kind of hearing that we actually need to have, where people are brought forward, witnesses are called under subpoena. Right. And, you know, this kind of investigation is what's necessary, not the kind of thing we saw today.
And again, I'm speaking with James Henry, an investment economist and lawyer who has written widely about offshore and onshore tax havens, kleptocracy, and pirate banking. The author of Blood Bankers. He's a senior fellow at the Columbia University's Center on Sustainable Investment, a global justice fellow at Yale, a senior advisor at the Tax Justice Network, and co-founder with David K. Johnson of DCReports.org, where he has an article, Wilbur Ross Comes to DC with an Unexamined History of Russian Connections. And by the way, the new investigative organization that you have founded with David K. Johnston, DCReports.org, you were the beneficiaries of a leaked tax return of Donald Trump's from 2005. David suggested it might have come from Trump himself. What's the latest on that?
Well, we don't know. You know, it was mailed from Westchester County, where Trump has a house. It certainly didn't hurt the president's reputation at first glance. A lot of people took from that, hey, he paid $38 million of taxes, including $36 million of federal income and $1.8 million of payroll taxes on $153 million, which sounds like, you know, a lot of money. It turns out that if you look beneath the surface, about $31 million of that came from alternative minimum income tax, which Trump has proposed to repeal. So, in the absence of that policy, he would have paid, you know, something like 3.5% of his income, given all the deductions he got. Secondly, we can't really tell from this 1-2 pages snippet very much about the structure of his income. We see that $67 million of the $153 million came from partnerships. We'd like to know a lot more about those international partnerships, because he has more than 500 companies around the world. And so if we really did get the whole return, you know, we'd be able to see, you know, did he report any offshore interest income, offshore interest payments on loans that he might have to these partnerships? Did he have any offshore bank accounts that he, you know, we saw Romney having two Swiss bank accounts, getting in a lot of trouble for that. But Romney had declared those on his returns. You know, certainly Trump has a lot more international business than Romney did. So the questions still, you know, are sort of lining up here. We can't tell much from the 2-page excerpt. And I think, you know, to be fair, Rachel Maddow spent a lot of time and got a lot of criticism for sort of hyping this thing. But at the end of the day, there's only, I think the burden of proof should go back to Donald Trump. I mean, what is he hiding? He's the first president in 40 years to refused to share his tax returns with the public. And there's a lot that we could be learning about his whole business empire, a lot of these deals he's done around the planet, if we had the 500 pages, not just the 2 pages, from his return, if we had all the other years.
Well, the opposite to Devin Nunes on the panel was another California Democrat, Representative Eric Swalwell, who went through a list of how many bankruptcies that Trump had and how he had to turn to capital abroad and how he made three trips. Trump himself made three trips to Russia and his son made 8 trips and said that most of our money is now coming from Russia. And again, I think this gets back to what seems to be the direction that FBI is looking into. So how does that play with the 2005 tax returns? Wasn't that the period when he basically took down a bunch of banks and was blackballed by Wall Street and had to look elsewhere for capital?
Well, as of the early 90s, we have him recorded video saying that he had $9.2 billion of debt. We know he had 6 bankruptcies in that period, and that during the period after 2000, he was having a hard time raising money. I mean, 2005 looks like a spectacular year, but one of the things is if you ignored any costs associated with the income and you capitalized $150 million, I mean, it's not, you don't come up with a gross stock of wealth of more than a couple billion dollars. So, and I think beyond that, you have to look at the net income. So I don't think he's as rich as he says he is. And I think during this period, especially during the 2008 period, he was having a hard time raising money. And if it hadn't been for capital flight from Russia, essentially the money was pouring out of Russia because of the problems with the rule of law and with the Russian economy during that period under Putin, you would say, this was a guy who was basically not financeable. So, did Russian capital flight, former Soviet Union capital flight, these projects, that's kind of the backstory for all of these questions. And I wish the Democrats would take a look at more of the economics of Donald Trump as opposed to just, this particular set of interactions with the Trump team and the Russian security services.
Well, specifically, though, what would you recommend they do?
Well, I'd like to look at an audit of all of his projects. I'd like to see a systematic audit of projects like the Panama Ocean Club, where the project starts in 2011 and lasts 3 years, $400 million project. Trump gets about $50 million out of the project. There's Russian organized crime types who are involved in selling the condos. The former president of Panama, Martinelli, is now sitting in Miami. Panama has extradited him, requesting his extradition because he helped himself allegedly to $35 million of school lunch funding. And he was the guy who basically helped Trump put that project together in Panama. So, that's just one example. There are literally a dozen or more projects where, the Baku Trump Tower in Azerbaijan with lots of oligarch money. The Trump Soho, where the Bayrock partner was, the director was a former felon, convicted of a bunch of crimes. The Trump Tower in Toronto, where one of the leading partners is arguably not unrelated to some Russian mobsters. I've gone through this in a number of articles that I published, but there's no substitute for having a subpoena power and for having a committee that's actually got a mandate to investigate this stuff. And journalists can only do so much. I think we're at the point where we really do need to have an independent commission with subpoena power able to look into this.
So, just in closing then, James Henry, given that it's not likely, at least there's nothing on the radar that suggests that there will be a bipartisan commission like Watergate to look into this matter and that this is the best we can get, where you have the Republicans being just ludicrously partisan and doing everything in the world to minimize. I mean, I imagine they just don't want this guy impeached because they want him around long enough to get their agenda passed. And on the other hand, the Democrats are laying all this stuff out. And then you've got these two intelligence people, Comey and Rogers, sort of, you know, who obviously don't like partisanship, sitting there just basically saying, I can't answer that. And, you know, at least what they did do was say, one, Trump lied, in effect, about Obama wiretapping him. And two, there really is an investigation into possible collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians. So to that extent, that's the achievement of the hearings today. But in closing, do you think that there'll be anything that'll come forth from this committee and its Senate twin?
I don't think journalists are not going to rely on this committee. I mean, we're going to continue to do our work. So I'm going to go personally and take a look at all these projects and line up another article that dissects them. Maybe we'll come up with some money laundering law violations that they should look at and add to the list of things they're investigating. But in this arena, I don't think we can really rely on Congress, unfortunately, to take the lead in this divided situation. And, you know, there's not going to be, realistically speaking, an independent prosecutor or, you know, even a special investigative committee looking at this. And I think Comey has got, you know, sort of, as we know, you know, some limitations on his ability to actually get into some of the issues that we are talking about here. So, you know, I think it's going to be difficult to expect very much from the process that we're seeing today, other than the continued kind of law jam.
Well, James Henry, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Good to talk to you again, Jim. And again, I've been speaking with James Henry. He's an investigative economist and lawyer who has written widely about offshore and onshore tax havens, kleptocracy, and pirate banking. The author of Blood Bankers. He is a senior fellow at the Columbia University Center on Sustainable Investment, a global justice fellow at Yale, a senior advisor at the Tax Justice Network, and co-founder with David K. Johnson of DCReports.org, where he has an article, Wilbur Ross Comes to DC with an Unexamined History of Russian Connections. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the apparent death of bipartisanship in foreign policy and national security.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
You can't hide your lying eyes, and your smile is a thin disguise. I thought by now you'd realize there ain't no way to hide your lying eyes.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Locke Johnson, who's a Regents Professor of Political Science at the University of Georgia. He served on the staffs of both the House and Senate Intelligence Oversight Committees and is the editor of the journal Intelligence and National Security. He has written several books on American foreign policy, including Bombs, Bugs, Drugs, and Thugs, Intelligence and America's Quest for Security, Seven Sins of American Foreign Policy, and his latest, The Threat on the Horizon, an inside account of America's search for security after the Cold War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Locke Johnson.
Thank you, Ian. It's great to be with you again.
Well, thank you, Locke. And let me just go through some of the highlights here today from the hearing before the House Intelligence Oversight Committee. This is from James Comey, the director of the FBI. I have been authorized by the Justice Department to confirm that the FBI, as part of our counterintelligence mission, is investigating the Russian government's efforts to interfere in the 2016 presidential election, and that includes investigating the nature of any links between individuals associated with the Trump campaign and the Russian government, and whether there was any coordination between the campaign and Russia's efforts. And then Admiral Rogers, the head of the NSA, said that the intelligence community stands by the declassified report it issued in early January that concluded that the Russian government attempted to influence the U.S. election in a way that helped Donald Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton. And then, of course, the other bombshell coming from James Comey was, with respect to the president's tweets about alleged wiretapping directed at him by the prior administration, I have no information that supports those tweets, and we have looked carefully inside the FBI. So another way to frame that is that Comey was calling the president a liar, and that Trump's campaign is indeed under investigation for allegedly having worked with the Russians to win the election.
Well, I think both these topics are worthy of investigation. In the first click case, the idea of manipulating American elections is very troubling. After all, the anchor of democracy is our free and open elections, and if foreign powers are trying to shift the outcome in one way or another, that would be a horrible thing. So I'm glad we're investigating that. Well, there is a bit of hypocrisy here because we've been involved in manipulating other people's elections too, most notably, I guess, the free and open election in Chile during the 1970s, in which the Nixon administration attempted to oust Allende, who was the president of that country. But that aside, it's troubling that the Russians have become so brazen as to think that they could affect our election. As for the second topic, another worthy topic, because after all, can you imagine if a former president or a sitting president at the time had tried to wiretap a presidential candidate? There are precedents for that. We do know that in earlier days, Lyndon Johnson, for example, wiretapped his political opponents when he was president. We know that Richard Nixon wiretapped just about everybody in sight. But that's why the Church Committee, of which I was an assistant to the chairman, Frank Church, encouraged the passage of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act in 1978, which really makes it impossible for Obama or anyone else to wiretap someone, because you have to go to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and get a warrant before you can do that. And the warrant has to justify exactly why you want to do it. And no court would justify Obama wiretapping a presidential candidate, Trump. So that's absurd, I think. The former question about whether or not the Russians are manipulating our election, I think probably has some truth to it, a lot of evidence to that effect. But Ian, it really raises the larger question of whether or not these intelligence committees, one in the House and one in the Senate, are capable of coming to the truth in these matters.
Well, clearly the idea that partisanship ends at America's shores was blown out of the water. I've never seen anything more partisan than this. As I mentioned in the opening, it was almost like two universes at play. but when you talk, you know, I mean, I think what's happening here is that we're becoming inured and numb to the extraordinary nature of the news cycle since Donald Trump arrived political world as a candidate, because frankly, the idea that the head of the FBI and the head of the NSA is saying, yeah, the Russians interfered and we're investigating whether the Trump campaign had collusion with them, and by the way, the president's a liar. I mean, my God, wouldn't that be earth-shattering? That makes, John Dean and Alexander Butterfield look like they were mild-mannered critics.
Yes, well, I think you have a good point. And I feel some sympathy for President Trump, because he's reaching a point where his credibility is deeply suffering, to say the least. And you may recall that Lyndon Johnson misled the American people several times about the war in Vietnam, about how we were about to win it almost any time now, and it never happened, of course. And he developed what was called a credibility gap. I've never seen a credibility gap the way that one sees it in the Trump administration right now. I'm not sure that one could fully believe anything that came out of the White House at this point, because they've changed their position so often, and every day there's a new surprise, and there are statements made that can't be verified. So it's rather sad for the country.
But the Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee were actually carrying Trump's water. They were doing everything. They were going through all kinds of mental gymnastics to make it seem like, or at least avoid what the real issue was, and keep trying to turn the focus onto leakers and press reports that they didn't agree with. I mean, I found their behavior, pretty shameful. I mean,
Yes, and as you know, the chairman of the House Committee was actually on the Trump transition team, so one would find it hard to imagine that he's going to be fully objective. And then the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee is a well-known Trump supporter as well. So, you know, one of the saddest things, Ian, about those two committees, and the Church Committee helped create them back in the mid-70s, and we were very proud that now we had two standalone, one in the House, one in the Senate, oversight committees to keep track of these intelligence agencies and national security questions. And those committees did very well for a while, but with polarization setting in Washington, D.C. in the early 90s, it affected these committees as well. If you look at those two committees from when they were created in the mid-70s to the early 1990s, they weren't partisan at all. They tended to vote unanimously for almost everything that came along. But in the early 90s, they were affected by polarization, just like every other committee on Capitol Hill. And now, almost every vote up there is along party lines in those two committees, even though intelligence ought to be way above any partisan wrangling. So, again, it's unfortunate to see that happen.
So, what did you think of the two witnesses, Comey and Admiral Rogers? Comey, of course, the Democrats are furious with him, particularly that Hillary Clinton herself blames him for her loss of the election. And I mean, I know, and I'm sure you know even more so than I do, Locke, from your work on these intelligence committees, that people inside the intelligence community are pretty disdainful, if not disgusted, by political partisanship. They really see themselves as being nonpartisan. And I imagine those two witnesses were maybe that's why they weren't answering questions.
Well, I think you've got a good point there. You know, Comey is an interesting fellow, and for most of his career, he's been a straight shooter and quite admired by almost everybody. But he's gotten himself in some hot water, as you mentioned, with respect to Hillary Clinton during the campaign, and now he's in a hot spot because, after all, he's as you said earlier, calling his boss, the president, a liar. So, but I must say, not everyone would agree with this, I'm sure, but I admire the man, and I think he's trying to do the right thing, and I think that they're going to continue their investigation in the FBI and see if anything can be found out about Russian tampering, where I think there's probably something really going on there, or did go on, and the question of wiretapping of the president, which I think is a dead end, because I think that's a flat fabrication. And then as for Rogers, you know, he's a consummate intelligence bureaucrat, and he's trying to keep the House and Senate Intelligence Committees happy, because after all, they're the ones who fund the National Security Agency, which he leads. But at the same time, he's got to answer to the White House, too, because that's his ultimate boss, the president. So you can see why they were squirming during the hearings.
But how do they provide intelligence to a president that believes the stupidest conspiracy theories and marginal, you know, non-journalistic people like Alex Jones and Breitbart, which is a highly charged right-wing political operation? Because, for example, you know, but what happens? See, he just trashed, Trump just trashed GCHQ, the British equivalent NSA. And GCHQ has been really at the forefront of a lot of important frontline, you know, early warning intelligence.
So let's
assume, just for the sake of the argument that they get, GCHQ gets an intercept that suggests that Putin is going to use the little green men to do a sort of stealth invasion of Estonia. And this is flashed to the National Security Advisor, General McMaster, and then he has to take this to President Trump.
Yeah,
and first of all, he doesn't have the right to actually go in and have direct FaceTime with the president, as all other National Security Advisors in the past have. He has to go through Stephen Bannon. So assuming Bannon lets him into the Oval Office, and then he says to Trump, we've got this crisis that you've got to act on immediately, and warn the Russians that they can't invade Estonia. And again, this is not happening. I'm saying this is a hypothetical. Will Trump believe GCHQ or Alex Jones?
Well, I think you make a wonderful scenario there, and the answer is he may well not. Because after all, in the past, he said, well, they got it wrong with respect to the attacks on 9/11. They didn't predict that well. And then they got it completely wrong when it came to weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. So why should I trust them at all? So he's got a kind of a reductionist, rather naive view of the intelligence community. And what he forgets to mention is that they've gotten a lot of things right. And they're absolutely indispensable for making good decisions. Because after all, we do, as a nation, spend about $70 billion a year to gather this information. And to completely ignore it would be like crossing one of your wonderful highways out there in L.A. with a blindfold on. I wouldn't recommend it. So it's the wrong approach to presidential decision-making. And there's a tragic irony here that so many hardworking people in the intelligence community, of which there are 17 agencies, with all this money we're spending, and we bring in, by and large, really good information that helps illuminate decisions and gives the president an advantage if he uses that information. But here's a president who would rather play blindman's bluff in the world, it seems.
And apparently the presidential daily briefing, he doesn't really read it. It goes first to Stephen Bannon, who edits it.
Well, that's not, you know, there have been presidents in the past who have had some disdain for intelligence. Ronald Reagan, for example, for whom I have a great deal of respect in many ways, only got a couple of presidential briefings during an entire year, one year that he was in office. And Bill Clinton on the Democratic side really didn't pay the kind of attention that he should have to intelligence. So presidents have gone up and down and to the degree that they take it seriously, but no one has been as bad about it as Trump is.
Well, Locke Johnson, I really appreciate your time and I thank you for joining us.
I thank you too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Locke Johnson, who's the Regents Professor of Political Science at the University of Georgia. He served on the staffs of both the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, and he's the editor of the journal Intelligence and National Security. He's written several books on American foreign policy, including Bombs, Bugs, Drugs, and Thugs, Intelligence in America's Quest for Security, Seven Sins of American Foreign Policy, and his latest, The Threat on the Horizon, an inside account of America's search for security in the Cold War. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the Gorsuch confirmation hearings today.
I'm more important in the USA than a spy for the FBI. I'm trained to meet the criminal elite, and I seek out wherever evil resides. I spy.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Garrett Epps, who's a contributing writer for The Atlantic and a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. He's the author of American Justice 2014, Nine Clashing Visions of the Supreme Court, and has an article at The Atlantic, Gorsuch's Selective View of Religious Freedom. Welcome to Background Briefing, Garrett Epps.
Ian, how are you?
I'm well, thanks, Garrett. And the hearings today before the Senate Judiciary Committee for Donald Trump's nominee to be the Supreme Court Justice replacing Antonin Scalia, Judge Neil Gorsuch, of course, present the Democrats with a pretty tough choice here. The base is basically angry at what happened with Mitch McConnell, basically denying them a seat, stealing a seat by letting Judge Garland twist in the wind for almost a year. And, you know, they're in no mood to, well, if anything, in mood for a bit of payback here. But then the political punditry and suggests that maybe this is bad strategy, that the 10 vulnerable Democratic senators, they're already, by the way, Republicans are running ads in their states in favor of Gorsuch and sort of putting them on notice. So that's the context, would you say, for this hearing?
Well, I suppose in electoral political terms, it is. You know, in sort of judicial politics terms, it's slightly different in the sense that there is, among people who actually work in the courts and around the Supreme Court, there is a complicated set of feelings. Garland obviously would have been a terrific justice. I have never met a single human being with a bad word to say about Merrick Garland. But at the same time, there's a kind of subterranean relief that even if only by accident, the grown-ups in the Trump administration actually handled this appointment. Gorsuch is someone who could have been named by any Republican president. He is a person of superb qualifications and someone whose temperament, though conservative, has been praised by a lot of people. And in fact, former acting Solicitor General Neil Katyal, who had a lot to do with defending the Affordable Care Act in front of the court, showed up to introduce Judge Gorsuch to the committee and say, you know, I disagree with him, but he will make a wonderful justice. So, you know, one of the a couple of problems that Democrats face is, first of all, it's not clear they have the votes. I'm not sure where the votes would come from to stop Judge Gorsuch. And the second thing is, you know, if you stop Judge Gorsuch, maybe he'll appoint Omarosa Manigault to the seat or Andrew Napolitano. So it's a complicated sort of bank shot they have to figure. And of course, the base is not interested in those sophisticated concerns. They're angry. They're angry because of Russia, and they're angry because of Judge Garland, and they're angry because of Roe versus Wade.
Well, of course, the consequences are, first of all, that it was the Democrats under Harry Reid that changed the filibuster rules in the Senate, because the Republicans were frustrating almost every executive branch appointment and every federal judge appointment, leaving open the Supreme Court. So, and as Trump has already told Mitch McConnell, more or less, go ahead, go nuclear, in other words. So that's what's at issue here, isn't it? Whether or not, if the Democrats filibuster, then the Republicans will go nuclear and lower the threshold. So,
well, that's a even more complicated bank shot, because you know that they could do the nuclear option now. They could do it in the next nomination. It really is, in a sense, almost a foregone conclusion. The one thing that might save the filibuster would be for Trump to keep shooting his mouth off, because I don't think even Mitch McConnell wants people to have the idea that he is taking orders from Donald Trump. Trump's credibility is not as high in Washington as he may think it is.
Well, but when you say there's two worlds, the judicial world and the political world, in terms of the judicial world, though, I don't see how it's not political anymore. I can't, you know, I mean, everybody talks about, and you just mentioned the widespread praise for both Garland and Gorsuch from all quarters. But nevertheless, what Schumer said about what happened with the Chief Justice, John Roberts, where he was a very genial, presentable guy, just like Gorsuch, and he said he would be the umpire and he called balls and strikes. And then he turns around and is behind Citizens United and getting rid of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. Arguably the two tools, if you will, or two most important tools in the Republican political toolbox, that with unlimited corporate money, they've been able to change the political landscape and take over the House and Senate and the White House. And by denying the votes of a lot of people in red states and other states, they've been able to get all of their people out and make sure that a lot of the people that are going to vote Democratic, largely minorities, have a hard time voting. So, you know, you could make the case that John Roberts is the best political strategist that the Republicans have.
Well, you could. I'm not sure where that leaves you. You know, I'm quite sure that Chuckie Schumer would rather not have Neil Gorsuch on the court. I'm not sure I see the path to somehow getting Merrick Garland onto the court. I don't think the seat is going to be left open until 2020. So the question is, what do you do? In other words, I'm not saying Democrats shouldn't oppose the nomination. I'm saying, how do you oppose it? And, you know, having spent today watching the hearings, my thought is that you go and you throw down in front of Judge Garland, who's a man of great integrity, The fact that he takes this seat under very, very soiled circumstances, extraordinarily unprecedented circumstances, in which, first of all, the sitting president was denied even a hearing on his nomination, and a vacancy was held for a year for purely political reasons. And secondly, his name, Neil Gorsuch's name, was put about by the Trump campaign before the election as basically an election item. Vote for me because I will name my Supreme Court justice from one of the following, a name that includes Neil Gorsuch. Vote for me because I promise you my justices will vote to overturn Roe versus Wade. You know, and so I think the question that should be asked before Gorsuch gets through the committee is, you know, Judge Gorsuch, tell us about your conversations with President Trump. Tell us about your conversations with people in the White House prior to the decision to nominate you. Did you give commitments? Did you make campaign promises? The Supreme Court has now been annexed completely to the partisan process, and we need an accounting of that. Now, I frankly think Gorsuch is a person of integrity, and I think these questions can be raised in a way that they educate the country and the court on the perils of this politicized confirmation process. You know, Gorsuch had a choice. He didn't have to accept this nomination. I understand perfectly well why he did. It was his life's ambition. But he did accept a nomination that was soiled, that has a smell of raw politics and even a hint of corruption to it. And he ought to be given the opportunity, and the country ought to be given the opportunity, to cleanse that and reassure the country that he would be an independent justice. And that when Trump, you know, we have a president now who is attacking, assaulting the very idea of an independent judiciary, who is threatening courts, threatening justices, judges, saying, you know, either support me or I'm going to loose the Comet ping pong mob on you. And at the same time going to the courts and saying, you must defer completely to my judgment about national security. What's going to happen? When what view will Gorsuch take when that question comes before him? I'm prepared to believe that he has complete integrity, but I want to hear him say it. And I think the country needs to hear him say it, and I think his fellow justices need to hear him say it, because we need to get out there in the political dialogue that this is a president who doesn't respect the independent judiciary, doesn't respect the Constitution, doesn't respect the Bill of Rights, and that he's appointing a justice whose position was procured by disrespecting the Constitution and the rule of law, and we need to get back to that.
And again, I'm speaking with Garrett Epps, who's a contributing writer for The Atlantic, a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, and the author of American Justice 2014, Nine Clashing Visions on the Supreme Court. And he has an article at The Atlantic, Gorsuch, a Selective View of Religious Freedom. Let's turn to your article, Garrett, in The Atlantic. And basically, what, as far as I can tell, what Gorsuch is most known for, the Hobby Lobby decision, and the book that he wrote about what he calls assisted suicide, which others now call death with dignity. So do those two, that ruling and that book, does that define him as somebody whose religious beliefs basically are so important to him that he would rule in such a way, for example, with Hobby Lobby, where the right of the employer trumps the right of the employee to get contraceptive coverage in their health plan, and in the case of the book that he wrote, those in terms of the loved ones of people of dying in agony, in what calling for death with dignity, would be denied that, and that their loved ones would have to die in agony because of Neil Gorsuch's personal religious beliefs.
Well, I hesitate to characterize Judge Gorsuch's subjective religious beliefs. I do think he is shaped by an intellectual tradition that includes a relatively culture-bound view of what religion is. And so in the Hobby Lobby case, he wrote in his dissent in that lower court case, he wrote that the owners of Hobby Lobby had religious objections to providing contraceptive insurance coverage to their employees, and that this would make them, he said, complicit in wrongdoing, in what they viewed as wrongdoing. And at no point did he take any cognizance of the fact that the decision to bear children, the decision to use contraception, family planning, sexuality, all of these things are issues of conscience for the individual employee as well. And so that when we decide a case like Hobby Lobby, being a judge, we have to balance the rights of and the conscience of the employer versus the rights and conscience of the employees. The employees simply did not exist in Judge Gorsuch's opinion and in Justice Alito's opinion for the court. The employees simply are mute. They are objects. They are under the control of their employers. If they do something the employer objects, this is seen as a religious burden on the employers, and at no point is their right of conscience considered particularly important. And I think that's a blind spot. And I think that, you know, Judge Gorsuch has a similar blind spot when it comes to assisted suicide. You know, having lived in Oregon, having seen the workings of the Death with Dignity Act there and been involved in litigation over it, I know that there's been a consistent attempt to paint the Death with Dignity Act as having a certain cast of discrimination against the disabled and so forth. That's a very extreme view, and it's very much at odds with what actually happens in the operation of the Death with Dignity Act, which is where individuals are given a good deal of control and a sense of control over their end-of-life decisions. But if you look at Judge Gorsuch's book, he adopts this extremely conservative view and says this is all discriminatory against the handicapped and should be shut down for that reason. And I think that that raises some questions about his judgment in this issue. And again, I'm not going to impeach his religious beliefs, but I do think it is something worth looking at.
Well, is it possible, though, Garrett Epstein, his religious beliefs might have evolved? My understanding is that his wife is Episcopalian, which is a pretty moderate religion, and or at least in terms of Christianity, a very moderate and often very progressive religious practice. And he supposedly goes to the Episcopalian church with her. So do you think his views may have moderated since he wrote that book?
Well, I don't think his religious beliefs are at issue. I think it's the way he sees issues and the intellectual tradition he comes out of. Now, that book is an early piece of work. I think it was his dissertation or thesis. And we all get older, and when I look back at things I wrote when I was young, I'm quite embarrassed by some of them. But I do think we ought to just take a look at his ideas. We ought to draw a line between that book and the Hobby Lobby decision and other things, and simply question, not his beliefs, not his sincerity. And by the way, I grew up Episcopalian. I can tell you that the Episcopalians run the absolute gamut from the most conservative to the most liberal. But I think the issue is, you know, what is his perspective? What does he see? When cases come before him, how does he see them? Because very often the way a judge first sees a case is the way it's going to come out. He saw Hobby Lobby as a case about the oppression of these powerful corporate owners. He did not have room in his vision to see that it was a problem also about the rights of the hourly employees and their statutory right to control their own reproduction. I think that's a failure of vision. Whether he's grown or not, I don't know. Hobby Lobby was only a few years ago.
Well, but I think that's what I find troubling about all of the conservatives on the Supreme Court is that, and this goes back to Scalia, who Gorsuch is replacing, and they never rule for the little guy. They never rule for the powerless over the powerful, for the worker over the employer, for the rich man over the poor man. I mean, that just seems to be the one thing that unites them in a very consistent way. And, you know, they're called conservatives. You know, that's one way to describe them. The liberals on the other side are called liberals. And frankly, they don't even resemble the liberals going back to, you know, the Warren court and prior to that with William O. Douglas, Thurgood Marshall. I mean, they're centrist in my mind. So I find the whole definition of Supreme Court justices as they stand today to be pretty wobbly.
Well, there's no question that the legal, the legal mainstream in this country is a good deal to the right of the country. That has been the result of a very consistent and successful effort over two generations by legal conservatives to shift the legal dialogue. But I do think it's important not to caricature somebody like Gorsuch, who in some ways, particularly in criminal justice issues, might be seen as a little more liberal than Merrick Garland. And one of the opinions that was referred to by Senator Kennedy of Louisiana in his opening statement today, you know, is a case in which a 13-year-old boy in school began to, I'm sure that none of us ever did anything like this, Ian, but imagine, if you will, he began to kind of burp loudly and in class and producing laughter and amusing, you know, making girls giggle and so forth, and disrupted the class. And finally, the teacher sent for the vice principal, and for whatever reason, the vice principal decided to send for the school police resource officer, and then for whatever reason, the resource officer decided to handcuff this 13-year-old boy, and he's arrested him for disorderly conduct and took him to jail for burping in class. And the court, the Tenth Circuit, upheld immunity for this officer, saying, well, it wasn't, you know, it might have been okay, right? Whereas Judge Gorsuch wrote a very fine four-page dissent where he said, what's wrong with you people? This kid was burping in class. You don't put a 13-year-old in handcuffs for burping in class. So, you know, his jurisprudence is more complicated than we might make it out to be. That said, he does have a conservative point of view. Anybody President Trump nominates is going to be conservative on a lot of these economic issues.
Well, Garrett Epps, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
All right. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you. Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Garrett Epps, who's a contributing writer for The Atlantic and a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. He's the author of American Justice 2014, Nine Clashing Visions of the Supreme Court. And he has an article at The Atlantic, Gorsuch's Selective View of Religious Freedom.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.